OTB's Mount Rushmore. 32 counties, one county representative choosing their sporting Mount Rushmore. Some decisions are easy.
And I was seeing teachers who had never expressed any emotion whatsoever lose their mind when Sonny was running in that home straight, trying to catch that bold spot.
Others are controversial.
Mayo's greatest celebrity fan now helps him earn his place on Mayo's Mount Rushmore is Kevin Kilbane.
Join the debate across all our social channels at Off the Ball.
George O'Connor, 17 summers in purple and gold.
And catch the live decision-making over the next few months on OTB AM, live every weekday at 7.30 a.m. on OTB Sports Radio. The OTB Podcast Network.
Golf Weekly on OTB Sports Radio, Ireland's first and only sports radio station.
Now then, you're very welcome along. It's another edition of Golf Weekly. If you are downloading the pod on a Thursday, as usual, if you're watching on YouTube, or if you're listening to us on Sunday afternoon on the radio, then you are most welcome. Coming up, we will chat to Carl Morris. Carl Morris is a name you will be familiar with if you're into your golf, a performance coach, psychologist, mind coach, all of those rolled into one to some degree or other. He's worked with over 100 professionals, including six major champions. Graeme McDowell from 2002-2003 territory onwards, with Darren Clarke, with Louis Westhuis and Charles Schwartzel, and many others. So that is on the way. We have spoken to him already. It's a really good chat, well worth sticking around for. First, to check in on the week that was, we have Fionn Davenport. Hello, Fionn.
Hey, Joe.
And Peter Lawrie, a former European Tour player and winner, now running the Spawell Driving Range, which will be open for business very soon, we think, we hope, Peter.
Hoping on the 18th of May. How are you, Joe?
Very well. Also, the 18th, you're back in business.
Yeah, touch wood, yeah. Now, we'll be pretty much first open with the golf courses. So there's plenty of social distancing between the bays, and you're pretty much out in the air. So, yeah, I think we're looking good to open.
Oh, fantastic. Well, let's start on then the reopening of golf, because that ties in neatly with it. The word came through in the past week or so that various restrictions will be lifting from the 18th of May. That's when the first phase of restrictions really lift. Golf clubs will open as part of that, but you must live within 5K of your golf course, which rules me and I would suspect most others out, to be honest. But, you know, such is life, and safely and cautiously is how we have to exit this thing. So that's absolutely fine. But I hadn't realized that we might be able to head along to the driving range if it's within our 5K. That's good.
Yes, and you'd be most welcome. And I think there's going to be a lot of arguments on tee sheets going forward in this 5K range from your golf course. That if you're living pretty close to your golf course and can't get on the tee sheet, you're certainly going to be going down the tee sheet going, he doesn't live within 5K. He doesn't live within 5K. So it could lead to a few interesting car park
discussions.
I wouldn't say punch-ups, of course. Yeah, discussions.
Is it not a, would there not be a kind of a big difference between, say, Dublin, where, as Joe says, I'd wager that most people don't live within 5K of whatever golf club they play out of, and the rest of the country, where, I mean, every town in Ireland has a golf club, so you figure if you're a member of your local club that you'd be living within a relative circumference that wouldn't extend much beyond 5K.
Yeah, but if you get a couple of golf courses that are out on the, you know, the inlets or out, you know, beside the sea, a lot of people would be living in this, you know, the town centre, and might be outside the 5K radius.
I think it's one of those things. They've made this decision, and golf clubs were not pretty much at the foremost of their minds, in fairness. This is just one of those things which has happened. I mean, I was very, very excited when it all first happened, and received a couple of text messages from the usual suspects saying, May 19th, I'll see you there on the tee time. And then the reality dawned. And I've just had a look, to be honest. So the limits will move from 5K on the 18th of May to 20K on June 8th. And then you go beyond 20K on July 20th. So July 20th is when I'll be able to get out there, as opposed to May 18th. That's quite a difference. So if you live within your 5K and you can do it safely, then enjoy it, because you're one of the lucky ones.
Yeah. To be honest with you, I think a lot of the golf courses might, you know, do a little bit of a quid pro quo in relation to members and stuff like that. That, you know, if you're a member of a golf course that's 20 kilometers away or within that, or within, you're living close to the golf course and you're a member of another golf course, I think there may be a chance of playing some golf.
Nice.
If they're wise, you know, make you a you know, partial member for that period of time.
That actually makes a lot of sense. And as welcome as this news is, and obviously paramount is safety and health. That's the single most important thing rather than our ability to play golf. But at the same time, it is worth pointing out is that it's great that members who live within a 5K circumference of the golf club can play golf, but golf clubs survive on green fees. And at the moment, I don't know, what's the deal? Like, I mean, is there any timetable for when non-members will be able to just rock up and pay green fee?
No, yeah. Nothing mentioned like that. And to be honest, I mean, from the point of view of golf clubs, and one unfortunately went out of business in Cork there in the last couple of days, I saw, I don't think this dramatically changes the economic outlook of golf clubs because they're not taking any money for food or drink or equipment, even in the pro shop. I wouldn't think. It's pretty much from your car park to the first tee. So the only people that benefits are the members who get to go out and play, and mental health and a bit of exercise. But if you're a golf club owner, Peter, and you have been involved in Luttrellstown in the recent past, there's no real difference between the members whose fees were already in the accounts playing or not playing.
No, but I probably look on the, you know, the private type style golf courses. And if somebody tells me that I can't take in visitors, I'm only allowed members, then, you know, is there a rule there or not a rule? You know, it's just it's a guideline from the GUI asking people to behave in a certain manner. But I personally think a lot of the private golf courses will accept green fees. Now, that's my opinion. And again, who knows what's going to happen on the 18th. But if I owned a private golf course, I would have to say, you know, I need some revenue coming in. And my members are, you know, going to be bringing in, they'll bring in some revenue. But, you know, I need visitors coming in as well.
No, I suspect you're right. And Fiona, it strikes me, you know, in some ways, lockdown is the easy part, because everybody was very clear about what we had to do, and that was not much, and nothing was open and the rules were very straightforward. It's almost as we exit this now and things become a bit grayer and rules can be bent a bit more and a bit easier, that actually the frailties of human instinct will come into effect and we'll start bending those rules and breaking the rules and doing different things. And that's where this could all get a bit messy and a bit difficult over the coming months. Golf will be a part of that.
I think we're going to see a lot of golfers coming down from Northern Ireland and playing in the border counties where they're allowed to. You know, there's no restrictions on them. So,
well, I think it's worth. I mean, I'm hearing only rumors because I'm waiting. It's either later today or Sunday that they're going to give some kind of timetable for the UK and the exit from our lockdown. But one of the things that I've heard from numerous sources, including the chairman of my own golf club, is that they're floating May 11th, maybe May 18th, you know, they're similar dates to Ireland for opening up of golf clubs. But I think, Joe, to your point, I mean, I must confess that as much as the lockdown has been trying for all of us, unquestionably, I've noticed in the last few days, as the horizon starts to show that we're going to loosen up, and is that there's a trepidation that's definitely come into my mood. And as much as obviously I would like very much to start reclaiming some of normal life, at the same time, it's exactly as you described, is that there's so much, I'd almost call it anxiety as to what this thing is going to look like, and so you can do this but you can't do that, you have to maintain this distance, and I think that a lot of us, and I include myself in this, is a lot of us are going to be very slow to kind of embrace this new thing, and there's going to be a lot of trial and error. And Peter was thinking about, like, there might be fisticuffs. I don't know. Not obviously, I'm not going to be doing it, but like, but I think there's going to be a lot of tension, and that tension is going to express itself in confrontation. I think that tension is going to express itself even with people who are going, you know what, I'm just going to stay in. I'm not going to go out. I think we're in for some very testing times. And I don't mean to sound an awful downer, but I think it's exactly as you say. I think there's so much uncertainty. And I think not everybody will be able to deal it in a kind of like, oh, sure, isn't everything great, you know?
On matters more at hand, Padraig Harrington was doing various interviews during the week. He was on Sky Sports, and he let slip that Luke Donald was going to effectively be his second vice captain alongside Robert Carlson. It was a very funny moment. It's great. You should check it out on Twitter. And, you know, he kind of acknowledges the cat was out of the bag, and promptly afterwards, the European Tour announced Luke Donald as vice captain, Roger Carrington. So that was kind of the highlight of the week in some respects. On Luke Donald, Peter, you know, you look at European golf now, we are heading into the bottleneck in terms of players who will want to be captain. So Luke Donald, 4 Ryder Cup appearances, always on the winning side, a former world number one. We are heading into a period where, in no particular order, certain dead certs like Lee Westwood, Sergio Garcia, I would presume Graham McDowell likes the idea of a US captaincy on US soil. Ian Poulter, for all he's done. Martin Keimer, 2 major wins, the winning putt at Medina. You have Henrik Stenson, 5 Ryder Cups under his belt, major winner. You have Justin Rose, 5 Ryder Cup appearances under his belt, major winner. And on it goes. And, you know, you don't even think of someone like Luke Donald who might have designs on captaincy. It's about to get incredibly competitive over the next 20 years.
Very much so. And there's going to be a lot of unhappy people out there. And it happened to a few players. Look at Sandy Lyle, never got Ryder Cup captain. Miguel Angel Jimenez missed out as well. And that's just to name 2. And there's plenty more out there who probably thought they should have got a pick or was at least put into the pot to be considered. Phil Price, his famous win against Phil Mickelson in the Ryder Cup at the Belfry. So there's plenty there. And as you say, Westwood, Luke Donald, Justin Rose, Martin Keimer, there's plenty of players there. And we're probably leaving out 1 or 2 as well, who think that they deserve to be in the mix.
So I presume, like, Garcia, you tell me here, I'll shoot the names at you, and you tell me who's guaranteed has to get it, right? So Lee Westwood is going to get it in Rome, we know. Garcia?
It has to go back to America then. So would you give Garcia in America?
Well,
possibly not.
You don't have to give me the year or anything. I just want to tick off who's definitely getting it.
Well, no, you'd be better off to go that way because I would say Poulter will be after Westwood.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Being in America. And that's where I would put Poulter. And then the year after that, you'd have to come back to Europe. And then it'll be a toss-up between Keimer and Garcia. Now, right. Garcia has, let's say, dirtied his bib a few times with the European Tour. Would you pick the perfect German to be your captain, or would you go for Garcia, who's been the kind of petulant child? I would have to go with Keimer, I would have said there. I think Garcia might get left out.
Do you really?
Yeah.
He's pretty much in the top 3 for Ryder Cup appearances. He's a major winner. I mean, he just sort of has to get it, no?
But is he in captain material?
Yeah. 2026, when it's back, it's Adair. So it has to be Graham McDowell.
Sorry, you're right. Apologies. Yeah.
Yeah, it has to be. Irish captain and Irish venue is, you know,
well,
no-brainer.
That's not a given thing. Who was the captain in...
Rusnam.
Yeah, we all thought he'd be captain in Wales.
Yeah. What about Paul Casey?
I can't see it.
Henrik Stenson and Justin Rose will get it down the line, won't they?
Well, depending. At that stage, they're a bit like me, over the hill. And, you know, really they're picking captains that are nearly playing at this moment. Like Harrington, you know,
yeah.
Okay, if he had a good year, he could possibly have made the team.
I'm amazed at Garcia. I understand what you're saying about his personality type, but that will not go down well at all if he's not picked. He will have had designs on that for a long time.
Well, you couldn't pick him in America, that's for sure, because he'll just get berated big time. Because I tell you a story. The one US Open I played in, it was in the Olympic Club, 2012. I'm on the putting green. I'm having a quick chat with Sergio. And this guy starts shouting at him. And an American, just not very happy with Garcia. And, you know, I think Sergio eventually said something to him. And he says, "Don't worry, Sergio. I'm going to be with you all day."
Oh, my God. So, that's awful.
That was his way to approach his first tee shot. This guy coming around, going to give him some abuse.
I was just going to say, I don't want to overstate the extent to which Sergio has grown up, because his antics in the bunker in the Middle East not so long ago would suggest he has a way to go. But he has grown up to some extent. And I would have thought, just by dint of the Ryder Cup career, it would be such an omission to leave him out that it'd almost be, you'd be creating a massive controversy that they'll want to avoid. But I mean, look, I bow to your superior knowledge. I mean, you'll have an insight into these things.
No, well, look, I don't think it's superior knowledge, Joe. I think when you put it together, the past captain, the current captain of the Ryder Cup, a member of the board, member of the players board, and the CEO, which would be Keith Pelly at the moment, pick the captain. I remember sitting when we picked Paul McGinley as captain. The question that I asked was, are we picking a person that is very good for the European Tour as a company, or are we picking a captain that is going to win us the Ryder Cup? Who's good with the players and the players want. And I never really got an answer to that. It was a kind of a bit of both.
Yeah.
Because after Nick Faldo, each captain has to sign a contract that they have to behave in a certain manner. They have to do so many press interviews. They have to, you know, wear the sponsors, you know, the likes of Rolex, the likes of BMW. You know, they can't have these different sponsorships with others. They have to go into the sponsorship of the Ryder Cup. So there's a lot to pick rather than just the past experience on the Ryder Cup as a player. And you have to look at who's been the previous captains and how well-rounded they are as a person and how well they present as well.
Okay. Very interesting. I thought that was going to be a quick discussion. Yeah. So you've thrown me there. There we go. Just before we get into Carl Morris then, who's the feature interview, myself and Fionn spoke to him earlier on. As I mentioned, he's worked with 6 major champions, talked about golf psychology from amateur level right up to professional level and major winning level. Fionn, anything jump out at you that you wanted to throw towards Peter in advance?
Well, I guess one is that, have you worked with a mind coach yourself?
Probably two. I worked with Aidan Moran. He was a professor in UCD many, many moons ago. And unfortunately, Aidan passed away there recently. But Padraig Harrington would have worked with him initially as well. And Aidan was very basic in what he taught, but it worked. And a bit like all kind of psychology, whether it be through golf or whether it be personal, you know, well-being and all the rest, they last a certain period of time, and then you click back into what you would call your normality, and then you have to give yourself a kick in the ass again to move it on from there. It's very rare.
What was the thing? But Peter, what was the thing for you that, I mean, and I, you know, take this on the level, it's like, what was lacking for you? Like, what did you analyze in yourself? You go, "Oh, I'm doing this and it's kind of going against me playing my best golf." So what was the thing that you needed help with?
I wish, and looking back at my whole career, I wish I was more confident. I lacked confidence. And I didn't take it, you know, I didn't even take winning well, and never mind defeat. Winning didn't sort of progress me onto the next level like it should have, because of lacking in that kind of self-belief. And, you know, if you go back through some of the players, like Ian Poulter is a great example of a person who has utter belief in himself. And that's where, if I was to advise anybody, especially coming up into the game, is to have belief in yourself more than anything else.
One of the interesting things in this interview, and that, in fairness, I found it all really fascinating, was and this I presume pertains specifically to the amateur golfer, to the everyday club golfer who's not doing it for a living. And it's to ask yourself, why are you playing this game? Like, what is it that you're deriving from this? Which I imagine can also apply elsewhere. But, and in my case, that really struck me as really powerful, really kind of profound, is that at one point, I mean, I've mentioned on the pod countless times ad nauseum, is that I lost my driver swing for the guts of a year and a half. And the frustration of it really kind of put me into a very dark hole. And I remember playing with Joe and a friend of ours, Ivor. And we were out, was it Kilcock we were playing, Joe, that day?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it got on me so much. And it got on me so much that I had tears in my eyes walking down the fairway on my own at how unhappy I was at this problem that I could not seem to resolve. Now, here's the thing. Was I going to see a coach? No.
Try having a career like that.
I can only begin to imagine that something that is effectively but a pleasant hobby for someone like me, what it must feel like when your entire livelihood is dependent on it. So at a much lesser level. But paradoxically, I was in the fortunate position is that I wasn't earning an income from this, so I could make a decision, I'm going to take a step back. And what it did is it prompted a massive reassessment of why I played this game. And as a result, it allowed me to, I never get that upset when I play badly anymore, ever, 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 ever. And it's not shame. It wasn't anything like that. It was just like, it's not, this is not what this game is designed for. Here I am with two of my closest friends and I cannot connect to the activity that we're engaged in. I just couldn't connect to it. And so that's what listening to Carl really kind of brought that back to me. And I was like, yeah, there's stuff about like really kind of focus on why you're playing this that really made a heap of sense to me.
Well, funny you say that. I went to the ends of the earth, and literally to the ends of the earth to try and figure it out, you know, what was going wrong and stuff like that. And funny enough, I was listening to Padraig Harrington on his Twitter feed the other day when he talked about his tee shot in the Open and how he worked back from that and what was going through his head and fear and other things. But I literally went through the whole mill, you know. And when I came out the other side, you know, it gets to the stage where nothing else, nothing is a problem. It actually wasn't the problem. It was, I had manifested it into a fear, and the fear was the problem. I had this unbelievable fear, and I went to swing coach after swing coach, trying to find it, and I would practice for hours upon hours. But there was nothing wrong with my game. There was nothing wrong with my swing. There was no need for me to hit this shot that was 50 yards offline. It was a fact that it was fear that had driven me. And when I realized that, you could actually work on it then. You could actually go, right, well, what am I actually, break it down, what am I frightened of? And a caddy that used to have, that I had initially starting out, Dermot Byrne. He used to say,
I know
to me,
Dermot.
Yeah. So, and he caddied for Shane and he was a brilliant caddy. And he used to say to me in the early years when we were on tour and when I used to drive it great, he said, we've 14 golf balls in the bag. you know, if we lose them, we just walk in. So what's the problem? You know what I mean? Like, let's go. Hey, we're not going to lose all 14, but if we do, we do. You know what I mean? And don't be worried about it. Just get up there and hit it. And a lot could be back to the amateur as well. You know, if you're playing in your Sunday medal, or even when you're going out now after lockdown, is just go out there and just hit it. You know, just hit it. And don't be worried about where it's going. If you have, and I know Carl Morris will talk about this, you know, picking a very minute dot down the fairway to try and land it on. But initially, just pick a target and hit it. Don't be worrying about anything else. Don't be thinking about your swing. Just get up there and just give it a smash. And funny enough, as a child, that's exactly what we'll do. You know, for every sport that we play, a child's mind is where we want to be. They have no fear. They don't worry about if they hit it, if they miss it. So what? And that's what golf should be to the majority of golfers out there. And even to a lot of the pros out there who think far too technically and worry about it far too much. And I think you could get the guys who are 160th in the order of merit, and you could change their world in a matter of seconds if you could get them to believe that it actually doesn't matter. And one of the books that I used to go back to an awful lot throughout my career was What to Say When You Talk to Yourself. And it had nothing to do about golf. It had all to do about my inner self. And we all do it. You know, we, you know, talking to our children, you know, you can't do that. You shouldn't do that. You know, all negatives. Rather than saying, okay, you did that, right, park that, this is the way we should do it. And a lot about it in you know, worrying about. I used to play on the first tee, I'd be going down the first fairway, and I'd be thinking about the 13th tee shot on the 13th hole. And, like, that was just crazy stuff. Like, why? I'm not even enjoying, as you said, going down the fairway, even having a chat with the guys. I'm not enjoying that, or I'm not enjoying trying to make birdies. I'm worried about getting to the 13th. And when the 13th was gone, then I could relax. So, you know, your mind is one of the most powerful things that we all have. And if we treat it right, it can be very helpful to us. If we treat it badly, it can be very destructive. Enemy.
Yeah. And maybe a last point then, as we segue into starting Carl Morris, which ties in with what you've been talking about. He would often start sessions with the players he's worked with by asking them to describe their mindset when they were playing their best golf. So maybe let's do that with you. When you were playing your best stuff, when you were winning, when you were competing, where was Peter Lawrie's mind? What were you doing in those rounds?
As empty as a Coke can, let's put it that way, because there was nothing there. There was, all I was trying to do was make birdie. So it was hit it down the fairway, right, next shot, what are we trying to do? Hit it straight at the flag, go for it. You know, it was aggression, but it was relaxed aggression, if there's such a thing. Mm-hmm. And I had very little fear. I never worried about anything. Like, I go back, somebody asked me, I was doing an interview there recently, and I was asked, you know, what was the best shot I ever hit in my career? And I would have said probably the 7-iron out of the bunker in the Spanish Open playoff. Did I even think about the water that I had to carry, or the water on the left-hand side of the green? No. Just took out the 7-iron, hit it straight at the flag. And that's where it has to be, you know, to play your best golf. That's where your mind has to be. Never mind professionally, as an amateur as well.
And what percentage of your career was played like that? And what percentage was played thinking technical thoughts and worrying about the 13th?
I'd say pretty much from 2003, I had a great spell, probably up to 2012. I just had a very free mind. And you know, I suppose maybe early on in the season, you'd be kind of a little bit concerned for your card and you'd be pushing a little bit. But then after that, like I most years I had my card sewn up by kind of April, May, before you're coming even into the big tournaments. Mm-hmm. And you know, you're nearly freewheeling at that stage. Mm-hmm.
They call it that thing you were talking about, that relaxed aggression, is equipoise, that balance between the aggression that you need to really go after shots and play holes, but also that relaxation that allows it to kind of float along. So, and you know, I mean, I know from other sports that it's really, really hard. Once you get it, it feels like the most natural thing in the world. But if you're out of it, it's very, very hard to kind of find your way back in.
Get back into it. Yeah.
Well, very interesting. Peter, thanks very much. So we, Peter Laurie there, Fionn Davenport, myself, we are going to bring you an interview we recorded earlier on now with Carl Morris. Have a listen. Now, as promised, we're delighted to welcome a man who has worked with just the 6 major champions in his time and over 100 professional players as well. He is Carl Morris, a name familiar to many of us, not least because of his association with Graeme McDowell or Darren Clarke. Carl, it's great to have you on. How you doing?
No, it's great to be with you. Looking forward to it, Joe.
Just the 6 major champions.
Yeah, we need to get into double figures in the next few years. That's assuming we get back to playing competitive golf at some point.
I know. Well, indeed. Well, here's hoping. So you, and I don't want to put labels, but in effect, you will work with golfers on their psychology, as I understand it. And golf, as everybody listening knows, is very tough from a psychological point of view. Dermot Galise in the Sunday Independent had a great piece the other weekend, and he was talking about the difficulties of golf. And he said, I'm reminded of American professional Bob Toski's description of golf as a non-violent game played violently from within, which is just a brilliant quote. And he also mentioned Billy Casper, who said, it puts a man's character to the anvil and his richest qualities of patience, poise and restraint to the flame.
Yeah, I've heard the Bob Toski one before, and it's a great one. And you're absolutely right, Joe. I think whatever we have within us, the game of golf will reveal it out on the golf course. You know, if there's ever a way of getting to the heart of understanding or knowing somebody, go and play 18 holes with them. I actually heard a great story years ago. A guy, I won't name him, but he was very, very well known professional, and he had a system when he was interviewing prospective assistant professionals. And he said, I don't bother with CVs or anything like that. He said, I just get them to apply for the job. He said, and then I say that we're going to go and play golf at 6 o'clock in the morning. We're going to go and play 9 holes. And he said, that tells you everything about the character. You know, all I need to know if they're late for the interview, and whatever they've got in them will be revealed on those 9 holes. So yeah, you're absolutely right. The game lays us bare, but that's why we love it.
Carl, you might just give people a sense of your journey thus far. I know you were a promising amateur player, a classic practice ground player is how you described yourself.
Yeah, I won 5 majors on the practice ground, Joe, but unfortunately it never transferred onto the golf course. It was a classic one with me, you know, as I took up the game. Cricket's my first love and passion, but I took up the game of golf, and within 12 months of starting playing competitively, I'd shot level par for the first time, without really any lessons at all. I just sort of got out there and played and found a way of getting it round. And then, of course, when I'd done that, people started to say, "Oh, you know, you've done well with this. You need to start taking lessons." Well, about another sort of 15 years later, in the pits of despair about the fact that I've got worse and worse at the game, I sort of thought that surely there's a different way to this, and I was lucky I'd turned professional by then and was more interested in the coaching. But I started to see a similar pattern with what I was doing with lessons that happened to me. You know, I was, as Fred Shoemaker said to me years ago, he said, don't pass on to other people the things that haven't worked for you. And that kind of really rang true, because I was sort of, you know, coaching mechanics of the swing and things like that, and seeing people good on the range but not transferring onto the golf course. So it kind of started a journey of being interested in the whole performance aspect of it and the role that the mind plays. And, you know, 20 odd years later, we're still searching a little bit, but I think I've definitely not got all the answers, but I think I ask a few better questions these days.
Carl, can I just ask you, people in your profession are usually described as mind coaches. And can you talk to us a little bit? There is a qualitative difference between mind coaching and psychology, because you're assuming that the person in your charge is psychologically okay, and you're kind of just improving them. Is that? I mean, I don't want to make it too simplistic.
No, it's a great distinction. I mean, it's you know, I think if somebody's got, you know, real issues, deep-seated issues, that, you know, life pathology or whatever, that's not my remit. I would be the first to sort of say, you know, you need to go and see somebody. You know, if it's depression, you know, whatever those deep things are, that's not my remit. You know, that's for trained professionals in that area. But yeah, what I look at is the assumption that the person in front of you is pretty good anyway, but how can we make it better? Because, you know, most people see a big gap between what they know they're capable of and what actually comes out on the golf course. So it's kind of getting a real understanding of what that individual is about as a golfer. And then, you know, just finding some different approaches and some different ways of playing the game that actually release out what they're truly capable of. I'm always clear to say to golfers, you know, working with me, I can't give you what you've not got. You know, if you've got a dreadful golf swing and you know, hit it sideways on the range, working with me is probably not going to make much difference. But, you know, I can give you better ways of developing skills. But if you're the classic golfer that, you know, really performs well on the range and you've got reasonable technique, we can make some serious progress, because, you know, I feel as though I do understand how to transfer those skills more onto the course itself now.
So what tends to happen to the golfer on the walk from the range to the course?
I think there's a whole multitude of things there, Joe, with that. You know, I think one of the things classically with a lot of golfers, they don't really understand enough about, we spend so much time analysing the golf swing. But when you think about it, when you play golf, 90% of the time that you're on the golf course, you're not actually playing. Something else is going on. And, you know, this is a broad generalization, but a lot of club golfers, when they play friendly golf, they'll be chatting away to the mates in between shots. Then they get to the shot and they, you know, they create a shot there. But then when they go and play in competitions, they think, all right, now it's time to be serious. Now it's time to focus and concentrate. And they get so intense that their ability to then release their ability and create shots when they get to the ball is lost. So we look quite a lot at, you know, what is it that you do in the in-between time? What is it that gets in the way? Where does your mind go in that in-between time? And then very much about having some processes that allow you to create the shot in that moment on the golf course that doesn't involve trying to place your body in certain positions. You know, again, one of the things that I heard years ago that, you know, unfortunately your muscles don't understand English or German or French or Japanese, that the language of the body is very different than the intellectual analysis of trying to place the club in certain positions. And although that is really appealing to people, that they might get the secret from somebody and they might have the answer in the swing, our sort of collective experience isn't the case. You know, and most golfers, if there's one word that they describe, Joe, I mean, I've often asked tour players, tell me about the best golf you've ever played, and if you could describe your mindset, what would it be? And they often come out with one word over and over again, and that's calm. That the mind is in a fairly calm place so that the body can actually release what it's been trained to do. So it's exploring where your attention needs to be on the golf course to release what your capability is. And unfortunately, the way most of us practice, you know, we stand on a range and if we get a bad shot, we can fix it straight away by raking another one there. So we don't have an interval in practice, and then we get on the golf course and there's a huge interval between each shot. So I call it the 90%, and we you know, we ignore the 90% at our peril, really.
Is in your professional assessment, and obviously having observed golf for many, many years, let's take it for granted that most of us amateurs would certainly fall into the traps that you've just outlined. I know I do. I do it all the time. But if you were to, without naming names or name names if you want, but looking at the across the range of professional golfers, do you think that most of them have been able to find a measure of that calm or that peace or that focus on the task at hand that you're talking about?
At times, you know, it's interesting, even with the best in the world, that they fall into exactly the same traps that we do as club players. You know, that if you see it on the European Tour, the best players, when they're playing the best golf, will tend to have very few technical swing thoughts. But the easiest thing to do when you're struggling with your game is go down that route, because there's only too many people willing to give you advice on what they perceive you're doing wrong in your swing. And I think, you know, the best players, I mean, Graham, I know it's well on record, I've, you know, worked with Graham McDowell on and off for over 17 years now, and you know, Whenever we speak, Graham will often say that, you know, you're only going to remind me of what I already know, which is the case. But even the best players in the world, you know, I heard him on a podcast recently, and one of the things Graham always said, that he plays his worst golf when he ends up playing backswing golf, when he's getting too absorbed in what he's trying to do in the golf swing. Now, there is a time and a place for that, obviously, but, you know, when the better players are more absorbed in creating shots rather than swings, that's when more of a calm mindset takes place. You know, Graham's a fascinating study. I mean, there are not many golfers that I can think of that the more pressure that you put them under, the better they play. Mm-hmm. But he is in that category. I mean, if there was a guy that, you know, you wanted to see, he had to save your life by holding a 6-foot putt, McDowell would be in one of the top five to actually knock that putt in for you. Because, and he really interesting when he talks about it, you know, I've discussed with him about winning the US Open and the time when he held a winning putt in the Ryder Cup. And he said, it was interesting when he said, when the pressure's so intense, he said, for him, it's almost as though everything just shuts down. And the only thing that he can focus on is moving the ball from A to B. It's a weird kind of scenario that the more intensity that there is, the more that process that we're trying to get a lot of others to do actually happens for him. Whereas, you know, a lot of people under real pressure, their attention starts jumping everywhere because they're into outcomes and what may happen and all the rest of it. And, you know, he obviously won again in Saudi Arabia recently after a bit of a drought. And I said to him, I said, you know, you might have lost your game for a while, but you never forgot how to win. And great example of that.
It's one of those interesting examples because I've known golfers who've played with him and against him in the early days when he was coming up through the ranks and so playing whatever, the four provincials, etc. And one of the things that unequivocally everybody said about McDowell was that when he walked into the room, he carried with him like a burst of confidence and a self-belief, the likes of which, and I've known people like Ramy Burns or Kieran McMonagall, really talented golfers who said, this is like, you're looking at him going, geez, there's a guy who absolutely believes in himself. Do you think, like, I appreciate that everybody who reaches that elite level has to have self-belief, has to be able to get through all of the doubt. But if someone like McDowell has this kind of preternatural self-confidence, do you think that he comes already kind of pre-equipped before even, say, kind of dealing with the stuff you're talking about?
Yeah, I think there's a mixture there, Finn. I think, you know, Graham, from early days, has always been a phenomenal competitor. And I do think, you know, and I'm not just saying this because you guys are it. I think the structure of golf in Ireland, I've always been very envious of it because I think it is geared to golfing excellence. You know, when you think right from an early age in Ireland, it's a big thing to play for your club, isn't it? And all the sort of, you know, the Barton Shields and the Senior Cups and things like that. So competitive golf is massive in Ireland and they love to play that. Not in a way that we don't, certainly over in England, not to the same degree. You know, there's in every club, there's 10 different teams representing, you know, whatever handicap levels they are. So I think being brought up in that environment of being out in competitive games, representing your club is an unbelievable training ground. And I think it's played a big part, you know, Clark, McDowell, Harrington, Hoey, you can name a whole bunch of Irish golfers in the last 15, 20 years who've done really well. I think put that with Graham, I think he's a very, very bright man. He's a very, very bright man. And he's always, from an early age, looked at every area to improve. Now, certainly the mental game, we first started working together in 2002. And if something makes sense to Graham, he'll go away and work on it. You have to give him a rationale behind it. You know, you can't just say, sit under a tree and chant and everything will be wonderful. There's got to be a rationale behind it. And I tried that and it didn't work. But, you know, there's got to be some sense behind what he's actually doing. But once you give him the rationale, he'll go away and work on it. You know, and he's always said that the confidence comes from turning up, knowing he's prepared to play. Mm. You know, and he's great because he knows his game as well. You know, I remember, you know, one tour pro to remain nameless, remember saying to me once that, you know, McDowell's not got a particularly good golf swing, has he? And I said, I said, well, I said, that's a question that's open to debate. I said, the good news is that Graham's golf ball doesn't know that he's not got a good golf swing. You know, and you know, again, I think we've you know, perhaps something we can touch on. I think we've for so long in this game been dragged into aesthetics and how something looks. And we like a swing because it conforms to certain things. You know, Graham McDowell may not have a style that we appreciate, but he's got incredible skill and he understands what he can do with the golf ball and having how to get the golf ball under control. And that would be one of my wishes with all of this, that we've taken time, we've had a chance to reset and not play the game for a while, that we all just sort of go back and start focusing much more on skills rather than style. What skills do you need to develop to become a better golfer rather than being constantly being obsessed with how it looks? You know, if I see another, I mean, I don't do much on social media, but if I see again another before and after, look at this swing, he was doing this, now he's doing that, I'll scream, because there's no context to that unless you know what shot he's trying to play and whether that new swing can actually produce those shots. So I think the more we get into swings rather than styles, more we get into skills rather than style, I think we could start going down a far more productive route for a lot of people playing golf.
Yeah, it was interesting. You quoted McDowell there saying he doesn't play well when he gets into playing backswing golf. Mm. And even at amateur level, we've all hit bad shots and watched other people hit bad shots. And the first thing they do is rehearse their backswing and look over their shoulder and say, right, that's the answer. So clearly when we're not playing good golf, and when we are playing good golf, the bad golf tends to be very technical and how's my grip and what am I doing? And, you know, you talked about how muscles don't understand the English language there. So all of this is knitting together. You know, you're talking about the driving range and the difficulties then in terms of trying to take what is very little to do with golf onto a golf course, from a range onto a golf course. And you talked about calm there and you're not thinking about technique. So how do we get into that space? If that's what the pros do, and if that's what even we rank bad amateurs have had glimpses of when we're playing our best stuff, that sense of calm. Talk to us about what you want us to be doing on a fairway, looking into a green, because it is most certainly not rehearsing our backswing in a technical way.
Yeah. Well, I think sort of great question, Joe, and going back to what we're sort of heading towards here, one thing I would suggest for everybody when we get back to it is decide, okay, I'm going to try and improve my golf shots. Okay. So what shots do you want to play? What shape do you want the ball to have? Now then, once you have an intention, and you know, you can win major tournaments, it doesn't mean to say that moving it left to right is a bad thing. You know, fading it is not a bad thing. Everybody doesn't have to draw the ball to be a decent player, but have an understanding of what shots you're trying to play. So let's say you want to hit a draw. Okay, then what's the number one factor that's going to influence whether you hit a draw or not is the interaction between the club face and the ball. And the ironic thing is, we're probably the only sport where we look everywhere in terms of getting better, other than with the implement that we've got in our hand. We're obsessed with body positions, but the only thing that the golf ball reacts to is the message that the club gives it at impact. So my thoughts would be, okay, work on shots. And if you can't hit a draw, okay, work with a coach, but have a clear understanding, what does the golf club need to do to actually produce that shot? You know, if you think about it, if you look at cricket, if you look at tennis, if you look at hurling, all of those things, I would imagine anybody any good at those sports is just so connected to the bat or the racket that they know that if they do this, the ball does that. With golf, most golfers are so detached from the thing that's in the hand because they've been told to move the bodies in certain ways. So, okay, then you go, what shots are you trying to play? What do I need to do with the golf club to produce that, to make that happen? What does the interaction need to be? And when you can start to build that, Joe, you can be getting out on the golf course, and then it's much more, okay, I'm trying to move the ball from here to there. What shape do I want the ball to have? What feeling do I need to, with the club to produce that? And it's amazing when you start to get people thinking more in this direction, and it's more about shots rather than swings. Because as you say, you know, you hit some bad shots and somebody in the four ball says, oh yeah, you know, you took it on the inside, or you're swinging it upright, or you turn it up. I mean, it's just all, it's we're missing the point. What did the golf club do? And the thing is, when you work back from that, if you're aiming to hit a draw and the ball starts left and fades to the right, well, trace it back. What must the club have done at impact to produce that? And when you start getting into that, then there's an end goal, there's an end point, because you can start to create a relationship between golf club and ball and work back from that. And I think, you know, developing more skills creates a sense of calmness that you feel like you can do the job. So I hope that's answered the question. I've probably gone around the houses there, but hopefully it's moving us in the right direction.
It does. And it seems that's better done actually playing the game. Like if you were to teach a kid how to play, I mean, the idea of saying stand on that one spot and just hit balls all day seems terrible. We've almost lost the art of playing the game. So would you almost advocate getting out there and getting away from the range a lot more?
Definitely. That would be my number one hope. And it looks like if we're going to get back, that ranges may not be open first, but golf courses will. And that to me, you know, the thing is, Joe, in the last few years, I've said to so many coaches that I've worked with, that myself included, you know, spend more time with people on the golf course, because you learn so much more about the player when you actually watch them play. You know, seeing somebody on a range hitting 50 balls off a mat is just a snapshot of a much bigger picture. And what we tend to do is just jump in at swing positions. When you get out on the golf course, see how somebody sets up on the golf course when there's out of bounds on the left. How do they react when there's water on the right? What are they like pitching from 90 yards? What are they like at bunker shots? So, you know, to me, that would be my hope, that after this, that more golf coaching is done actually out on the golf course. And you can get so much more benefit. And yeah, there may be some little adjustments that you work on to help players produce the shots. But can you imagine any other sport where a coach never sees a player play the game that they're coaching? And it's bizarre. I mean, can you imagine a coach in other sports, like football, not seeing his team on a Saturday, and he just says, come and see me on Monday and tell me how you played? I mean, it's just, it's crazy that we've had this model for so long, and I know there's economics involved in it, but you know, if you're really going to understand what a golfer does, you need to see him play or her play on the golf course. So yeah, you know, this idea that it's got to be technically perfect and aim the face and do all this kind of stuff, I just get really excited when we can get away from that. And I think, you know, some of the falling numbers that there's been in golf over the years, everybody said it's because of time and it's too expensive. But I'll tell you what, it's surprising how human beings find the time and the money to do things that they really enjoy. You know, so if we were enjoying the thing more, we'd maybe probably get more people playing it.
Carl, how much import in terms of what you do when working with golfers do you put on the fact that, I mean, you mentioned tennis, hurling, cricket, that unlike all those other sports, golf is a still ball game. So all the energy on the golf ball is being imparted by you. You're not responding to a ball being thrown at you. How important for you is that distinction?
It is to a degree, but you can almost, the thing is, when you can almost make it not quite reactive, because it's never going to be as reactive as cricket or tennis or whatever. But I think when people understand that when they get to the ball and they create a shot first in the mind and they go through a series of steps, there can be a flow to that that almost creates a reaction when you get over the ball. You know, and as a massive generalization, I think what most golfers do is they don't spend anywhere near enough time thinking about the shot, and then far too much stood over the ball thinking about how they're going to move. You know, and I mean, we've seen Padraig Harrington doing the sort of Happy Gilmore running up to it and hitting it. And you know, most golfers, actually, I do an exercise I've done for years with a lot of players where you line six balls up on a range and get them to move down the line and hit one after another. And it's amazing when they get it, they top the first couple, but once they get into a flow, fourth, fifth, sixth ball, they'll be flushing it because they're not too absorbed in how to move. They're just reacting to the ball. So as I said, when I'm working with somebody, I'm trying to get it where there's perhaps a little bit more processing going on pre-shot. But actually, once you're getting into it, we want you to react to the pitches that you've put in your brain and make it a little bit more reactive when you get to the ball. Because you can guarantee, you see the guy standing over it for a long time, you know, it generally doesn't end well. You know, it's not usually a good outcome that. And you know, I think putting's a great example of this, isn't it? You know, most golfers playing the game will say they putted pretty well as kids, and then they've got worse as they've got older. And you think, okay, why is that? Because it's not a complex physical demand to hold putts. But what did we do as kids? Most kids, if you watch them putt, and again, this sounds too simplistic, but they'll look at the hole, they'll look at the ball, and they'll think, I've got to move this ball into that hole, and they'll get in there, and they'll just react to the task. And then as we get older, you know, you see people there with all the chalk lines and the straps around the shoulders and the metronomes and the bloody gadgets and all the rest of it, and we're trying to be moving the club on a perfect line. And then is it any wonder that we get in our own way and actually people get a lot worse as they get older?
I totally accept everything you're saying, but is it not also true that as we get older, we attach greater fear to the consequence of our actions? Whereas, like when I was a kid, like, you know, who cares? Like, I missed a putt, nobody cares. Nowadays, I attach all kinds of external value to things. So all of a sudden, oh, I'm not going to shoot the score I was hoping to shoot. I'm not going to beat my playing partner. So all of a sudden, that same mechanical action, that putt, just becomes weighted with far more fear.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Ian. And this is a real interesting area that, you know, as you say, we can get to a stage where far too much of us as human beings are invested in where a golf ball goes. Our whole ego's on the line, you know, in terms of, you know. And do you know what? It's weird because I've been fortunate to work in some other sports, and I worked for a spell in rugby league in over here with the Huddersfield Giants, and I saw those guys train, and I saw them then play on a Friday, Saturday, Thursday night. And Jesus, I look at it and think, my advice to anybody thinking about playing rugby is don't. You know, and I love the game, but I just see the battering that they took in that game, and I never saw any fear, not outwardly. You know, you don't see rugby players terrified to go out on the pitch. But then you see the abject terror in people's eyes at the prospect of walking to the first tee, hitting a shot in front of two or three of their mates, or the, you know, a club competition or whatever. And we've all been there. And, you know, why is that? Because our ego's on the line. And I think it's really, again, time to sort of delve a bit deeper with this and sort of say, well, what game are we actually playing here? What relationship do we have with the game? And the paradox is, I say to a lot of players, you know, if you take putting as an example, if everything in your world hangs on you holding this putt from an ego perspective, good luck trying to hold it. And the ironic thing is that I'll say to players, and it sounds crazy this, but if you're actually prepared to deal with missing it, if you're actually prepared to deal with the fact you're not going to hold this putt, you actually create the freedom to hold it.
Yes.
So and again, it's the same with shots. You know, if we can accept that we are going to hit some crap out there, we are going to knock some shots offline. Do you know what? The more you can actually embrace the fact that most of the time you will not be anywhere near as perfect as that you think you are. The more you can do that, the more you set yourself free to actually play the game. But yeah. I think it's, you know, in answer to your question, again, hopefully this is a time to reset, is to just, you know, you said at the beginning, we can get a bit deep, and this is a bit deep, is to get really clear on why you're playing the game. What is it that you really, truly enjoy about the game of golf? And one of my coaches says that get clear on why you play golf. And he said, then the most important thing is to think about why you play golf when you play golf. You know, and we often lose the sight of that because people say, oh, yeah, I like the social side of the game. And then they go and three putt the first green, and then they don't talk to anybody for 16 holes.
Yeah.
You know, that's losing sight of your reasons.
Yeah. And you mentioned people not playing as much and enjoyment must come into it. And so again, to knit together the last couple of minutes, how we deal with the bad shots, how we deal with our expectations, how we deal with bad starts. I mean, there's no pressure like scorecard pressure in golf when you're off to a bad start. It hangs over you, you know, 3-4 holes in. You're already saying to yourself, well, I'm not going to win the competition for starters. And, you know, you get into this cycle very quickly. So our expectations, how we treat ourselves on the course. I remember listening to a podcast you were on maybe a year ago, 18 months ago. And excuse me if I'm wrong, but I'm 99% sure it's you. And you even talked there about your physiology on the course. It was something that stayed with me, to have in your mind that the round is not over until the 18th and anything can happen. Mad things can happen. And one of the tips you even had was, okay, you hit your shot. If you can see the flag in the distance, keep your eye line above the flag because it's your shoulders back. And from a physiological point of view, that just prompts all sorts of hormones, as opposed to slumping and frankly telling yourself you don't deserve to exist as you walk after your sliced miss hit. So that whole area is kind of crucial in a sport where 98% of it is not actually hitting a ball.
Yeah, you right, hit the nail on there, Joy. Yeah, I'll put my hand up and say it sounds like it would have been me. That's the sort of thing that I come out with. But yeah, I mean, what you're talking about there is a bit that most people don't even look at with the game. You know, we've talked about pre-shot routines, and we talk about what to do over the ball. But what's your behaviour going to be like after the thing's gone?
Mm.
Now, that's actually one thing that you have 100% control over if you choose it. Now, if beating yourself up and calling yourself an idiot and spiraling into a pit of despair helps you play better golf, well, you should probably keep going with those strategies. But for most people, they don't. And as you say, just a simple thing like, you know, if you look at the classic thinker pose, you know, when somebody's thinking, the head goes down, they put the sort of chin into their hands. Well, if you look at most golfers when they're struggling on the golf course, they'll actually be looking down, their eyes will be down. And the more you do that, the more you become internal, the more you start to mull over and the thoughts just run riot. But that simple idea of when you hit the shot, and we're not talking about this as some kind of Pollyanna thing that, you know, you knock it out of bounds and you smile to your friends and say, oh, it's a lovely day and I'm glad to be alive. I mean, that's nonsense. You know, let's be real about it. But if you just say to yourself, you know what, I'm going to play a round of golf, and after I've hit the shot, I'm going to commit today that I'm going to make sure that my eyes stay above the flag as I'm walking in between shots. Now, I'm not saying that's going to stop you hitting bad shots, but I promise you, it will put you in a position where you're better able, your reactions to the bad shots are going to be better. You know, we've mentioned him already. Padraig Harrington is a great example of this. You know, when you watch Harrington play golf, it's hard to tell whether he's shooting 65 or 75. And it's something he's worked on with Bob Rotella over the years, worked on his reactions, because, you know, Pete Cowan's a great one. He talks about this, that, you know, you can have a golfer with a great golf swing, but if he can't control himself and he can't control his temperament, you know, Pete often talks about attitude being more important than swing. And that's from, you know, a guy who coaches the swing. And he talks about his career. Pete was a great, great player, great ball striker. But he said he was the angriest golfer that ever lived because he couldn't accept anything less than perfection. And he looks back now and thinks, well, you know, that was what held him back. So, you know, we're not saying don't work on your game, but also work on your attitude as well. And one point you just made there, Joe, about you know, you start battling, you thought, oh, hell, it's over with for the day. Mm. Why the hell do we look at golf as being 18 holes made up of two sets of nine? It's crazy. It's a crazy mindset. You know, when I've done seminars around the country, one of the things that people often remind me of is that I'll say, well, when you play golf, instead of playing two sets of nine, why don't you play the game where you play six sets of three holes? And your task is to do as well as you can on each set of three. So no matter what you've done on the first three holes, you start again with the next set of three. And you play those three. No matter what you do, good or bad, you start again. It's crazy that, I mean, how many golfers listening to this will have played a round of golf, they play dreadful on the front nine, but because they restart after nine, they play great on the back nine. But that's, it's madness that we wait nine holes for that. So just a little simple strategy like that when you get back playing again. Divide the course up into six sets of threes. Mark it on your scorecard. You know, that's your task. See how well you can do on each set of three. Whatever's happened on the previous doesn't exist. Right, you start again. And it's an unbelievable... I know Rory's used that principle. He's talked about that at times when he's been playing in majors. Just breaks the task down. It shrinks the goal, because the goal of 18 holes is too big. And if we get off to a bad start, we can just chuck the towel in too easily.
Can I ask you this, just again, based on your own observation, is that we clearly it's against the rules. You can't have any golf podcast and not have at least one mention of Tiger Woods at some point or another in the, of the time. But like Tiger, who, as far as I know, has never talked about working with a mind coach, but given his almost supernatural ability to do so much of the things that you've described. But I mean, not just as a professional, I imagine that this is going back to his childhood, that he has somehow found some magic formula that allows him to go into this calm space that no one else can penetrate.
The magic fan has two components to it. And it's interesting, the story is not more widely known than this. I was fortunate, I was in China last year and I met up there with, I was doing a training course for Chinese coaches, the, you know, the Mind Factor certification. And I met with a guy called Rudy Duran. Rudy was Tiger's first ever golf coach. And I kind of heard these stories, but Rudy told me about, first of all, Tiger's mother, called Tilda, is from a Buddhist background. So Tiger actually from an early age practiced meditation. You know, now there again, that's the sort of meditate, oh, what's that? It's nonsense. Well, I look into it. I couldn't stress for people listening to this, look into the whole area of mindfulness and meditation, because what is mindfulness? It's the ability to pay attention to something that's happening now. Mm. That's basically what it is, but it's a skill that needs working on every day. So there's that element to his upbringing. But also the second thing was, his father, Earl, was in the Special Forces. And he actually, one of his friends was a guy called Jay Brunzer. Now, Jay Brunzer was a Navy psychologist, and he actually used to caddy for Tiger, and he used to do sessions with Tiger from an early age. So, you know, the idea that Tiger was just born that way and it all came to him, I think it's nonsense. He worked on that part of his game in a systematic way, in just the same way that he did in terms of his golf swing and his fitness. Now, I think it's been well documented at times he said that, you know, he's got away from some of those things because, you know, when you do something really well, you kind of take it for granted that that's what you do. And I think at periods of his career, you know, I would say there were times when his reactions to the shots were really quite poor. You know, he got away from some of those things, maybe got too much down the technical route. What the Tiger that we saw latterly, I would imagine more because he was laid off from the game and got more gratitude, got more of a sense of gratitude to be able to play. I think the golfer that we saw win the Masters last year seemed to have a lot more kind of equanimity about bad shots. The Masters itself was a perfect example of what we've been talking about. And Padraig Harrington commented on it on the back nine that he said Tiger's just hitting golf shots. And if you remember, he was just hitting that little left to right fade just to keep it on the golf course. And you're supposed to win the Masters hitting a draw on every hole, but he didn't. He was in control of his golf ball by hitting shots on the back nine on Sunday. So, you know, long-winded answer to your question, I'm sorry. But, you know, it's something that he's worked on. It was part of his background, you know, that the other thing that Rudy Duran said to me, because I said, you know, as a kid, what did you work on with Tiger? And he said, well, he said, all I did, he said, I didn't ruin him. That was the first thing he said. And he said, we just used to play games. And he said, all Tiger wanted to do was get out there, and he just loved creating shots. He said, even as a six-year-old, you'd give him a wedge and you'd say, I just want you to just hit this ball, Tiger, and make sure it draws as it goes into the flag. He's only just off the green. So he'd hit little draw shots with a wedge, and then he'd fade it and hit it high and hit it low. And, you know, he said, we just got him playing golf shots. He said, I don't think I ever mentioned a body movement to Tiger one time in all the time we worked together. But it was all about playing games, being competitive, creating shots, you know. And as Rudy said, he said, I didn't get in the way of developing. I just created the environment to allow him to develop.
Yeah, it's all fascinating stuff. I watched the Masters back recently, and it's on the 14th on the Sunday where Woods hits a fade and Harrington says, I'd love if right now we could see what he hit here yesterday because I'm sure it was a draw. And today it's just the humility to find the fairway, which we as amateurs sometimes don't have. If we take, you know, McDowell, who you worked with and you know, continue to for a very long time. I know you worked with Louis Westhuizen in the build-up to his win in the Open at St. Andrews, and Darren Clark and Charles Schwartzel, all different personalities, all different games. Is the remedy, for want of a better word, or the plan that you stumble on with each of them, is it pretty similar?
No, I would say it's very different, Joe. It goes back to, you know, what we were touching on before, is when you work with a player, is sitting down first of all, not jumping in, just find out their story, find out what the background is, what the influences have been and what makes them tick. And, you know, one of the questions I always ask good players is, tell me about your best golf, because everybody's obsessed with what they're doing wrong, but, you know, that's got a part to play. But what are you like when you're playing your best? Because success leaves a bit of a trail behind it. So I'm very keen on, you know, I remember the first time I ever worked with Darren, way back in Darren Clark way back in 2003, and you know, we sat down and he just played in the US Open and he played fantastic. It was when Jim Furyk won it, and Darren, you know, probably should have won that tournament, and we just sat down and I was probably a bit, well, not probably, I was a bit in awe of him, so I just sat there and listened, and you know, it was I remember it was an hour and a half, and he was just telling me stuff that was going on, and afterwards he said, oh, I was, you know, I enjoyed that, and I thought, well, I've not really said an awful lot, but I was I suppose looking back, I was slightly smart enough to just sit and listen, because I think we're all too good at just giving people stuff before we find out about them, you know. And again, you know, with Darren, we did some work, and then a while later, he won one of the WGC events when he you know, Tiger was coming at him on the back nine at Akron, and Darren played magnificently that week and holed a bunch of putts. And I remember we worked on a specific thing with his putting at Queenwood a couple of weeks before he went out there, and something clicked. And you kind of know with his plays when something really, really clicked, and he went away and worked on it and pulled a ton of putts that week, you know. So yeah, in answer to your question, it's everybody slightly different, but it's the key is finding out about them as individuals before you jump in and sort of start giving stuff.
So there was the Charles Schwartzel red dot, which might give an example.
Louis
Westhuizen at St Andrews, the red dot on his glove. You might that maybe is a good explanation or a good way, because I think he's talked about it as well. So that's an insight into some of the stuff you're doing with top players.
Yeah, I mean, that was again an interesting one. It was his manager at the time, Chubby Chandler, asked me to do some work with Lou, and we sat down. And he said, I'm just struggling getting into the shots. He said, I'm hitting shots. He said, and I hit the shot, and I just think, where the hell was I? I just wasn't with the shot at all. And I said, well, what are you doing in between shots? And he said, I'm concentrating in between shots. And I kind of explained that there's no way you can keep an intense focus for 5 hours. So we kind of talked about the idea of switching on and switching off in terms of concentration. And I said to him, what would you want to be over a golf ball if you could describe your state of mind? And I think he said focused or something like that. And I said, okay, well, if focused had a colour for you, what would it be? And he looked at me, it was the daftest question ever, and I sort of pursued it a bit further, and I said, I don't know, red, I suppose. And I said, well, went a bit further. I said, well, just imagine if you saw the colour red, and that was a trigger, just like a referee's whistle, to actually focus on the shot that you in front of you. And I'll never forget, it was one of those serendipitous moments. He said, what if I like put a dot on my glove or something? And I swear, I wasn't at my office. It was at the ISM offices, and there was a red marker on the desk. And why the hell it was there, I don't know. And he picked up the red marker, put a dot on his glove, and he said, yeah. He said that, and I explained how when you look at the dot, that can just be a trigger to focus on this shot. What you do in between shots, switch off, chat to your caddy, which they did. The caddy that he was with that week was brilliant at it, at distracting him and talking about anything but golf. Mm. You see that red dot, is a trigger, right? You're in this moment now, you're going to play this shot. You know, and the kind of the rest is history. It got quite a bit of press at the time. And the funny thing about that afterwards, I started seeing a lot of people with red dots on the gloves. And I remember going up to one chap once, I saw some of the tears, he said, yeah. I said, yeah, so you've got a red dot on your glove. He said, yeah. He said, I've no idea what it's all about. He said, but I thought I'd give it a go anyway.
I've heard it before several times, and it's kind of a throwaway remark, but that said that the secret to golf is either you have to be really, really, really smart or the complete opposite. And in my mind, it's always been you have to be unbelievably inquisitive or not inquisitive at all, and that somehow, because most of us fall somehow in the middle, that's where all the problems lie. So is that something that you'd agree with?
Yeah, I think there is something in that, you know. I think the really bright ones, when I put, you know, your Jack Nicklaus is in that category, they're smart enough to keep it simple. You know, some other players, as you said, they're just not inquisitive, they just still react to the ball and produce shots. And most of us fall somewhere in between that, that we're trying to find answers and we're trying to create solutions, and the intellect wants answers and it wants positions and all that kind of stuff. So I think to make progress for those of us in that middle territory between, let's say they're not the brightest and the geniuses, that most of us are in that middle territory somewhere, I think it's maybe deciding that you're going to take the plunge and being smart enough to keep it simple. That maybe as you get back, you're not perhaps going to be drawn into the latest video on YouTube promising Nirvana because you drop your right elbow and produce ground reaction forces and all this kind of stuff that's out there. Maybe if you've tried that approach for 10 years and you haven't made progress, the 11th year isn't going to be the one that does it for you. maybe a different approach of, you know, sticking with this as well. You know, meditation provides a good example of this. You know, my meditation teacher says, you know, you don't just get this. You know, you'll sit down and you'll meditate, and some days you're over the place, and then the next day you just keep coming back to the same simple principles. And over a period of time, you kind of look back and you think, yeah, I'm making some progress here. We just tend to react too much, minute to minute, shot to shot, and I think TV makes this worse, because whenever anybody hits a bad shot on TV, the only analysis is that the golf swing. Well, we actually don't track it back, and we don't look at the fact that he three-putted the last green. He was raging mad because he three-putted the last green, didn't speak to his caddy all the way to the tee, and just whipped out a club that was inappropriate. Do you know what I mean? We don't look at anything other than swing positions.
Yeah. It's probably the area of the game, given how time poor we all are, where we could all improve very quickly mentally and knock a few shots off our handicap without having to make any technical changes. Carl,
The thing is, Joe, with that, with the best will in the world, we haven't got time to make major swing changes. I don't think most people don't.
But
instantly, you could have a better attitude the next time that you play. I think that way without question.
Yeah. Knock a shot off your handicap with just your attitude is very attainable. Carl, if this has piqued people's interest, where can they find more of your stuff? I know you've got books and you're on podcasts and you've got your website and you do various talks in right around the world. Where's the best place for people to check you out?
Yeah, I mean, probably the first port of the call is to look at the books, the Lost Art of Putting and the Lost Art of Playing Golf, which Gary Nicol and myself have written. They've been nice to see. They've had some good reviews. They've been on number one on Amazon for a while, so That's perhaps for the first port of call. For anybody interested in what I do, that my website is called themindfactor.com. As you say, Joe, I've done a lot of seminars over in Ireland over the years. I always love going over there. Hopefully that's going to return at some point. You know, I do a Mind Factor certification for coaches. We get quite a big community now around the world doing that. So you can do that online, or we have a training course in Manchester in November. So anybody's interested in that, just have a look at the mindfactor.com.
Well, Carl Morris, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much.
My pleasure. Really enjoyed it.
Golf Weekly on OTB Sports Radio, Ireland's first and only sports radio station.